Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Ellich, and this is Skylines, the City Metric podcast. If you're listening to this on Thursday the 22nd, then I am doing something terribly exciting today. I'm recording the first ever live episode of Skylines at the New Local Government Network conference in London's Guildhall, a very glamorous location there. But I'm not sure how that's going to go. It is possible that's going to take rather more editing, rather more technical fiddling than one would ideally hope. So I decided I'm going to hold that one back for next week to give us a chance to kind of, you know, clean it up, pretend it went rather better than it actually did, you know. So instead, today, you're going to hear a conversation I had with one of the authors of a book on the first US capital. The book's called In Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City. And I'll let my interviewee introduce himself.
So, I'm Nathaniel Popkin, and I'm a writer and author, and I live in Philadelphia, and I've lived here for 30 years, off and on, and I've lived elsewhere. I'm a long student of cities, generally American cities, maybe a little bit more, but you know, I've thought about and read about cities all over the world, so it's something that's important to me. I'm also a literary critic and an editor, so I spend a lot of time particularly with fiction in translation, and I'm always drawn to work by authors who try to characterize their city, who explore their city, who reach into that deep bucket that they have. I'm thinking like Rabi Jaber, a novelist from Beirut. And that's what motivates me to do the work I do. So for me, Philadelphia, in my work, I have written, this is my third nonfiction book that attempts to characterize the city, the contemporary city of Philadelphia, so the city in the present day. I've also have my second novel coming out, and so those books are set here, and they also tend to explore the same kinds of tensions that exist at the surface and then a little bit more deeply on the streets of Philadelphia. And I can say one thing, that Philadelphia, uniquely, I think, in the American landscape of cities, is always in kind of a tantalizing tension, the city in the present day with the city of the past. You know, it's always trying to reckon with the past, and then it's always at the same time very powerfully trying to reckon with the future. So it's always in tension with the future, that is the city that might be or the possible city. And that was actually the name of one of my books.
So Philadelphia is a pretty big city, isn't it? It's near the East Coast. It's in that kind of East Coast metropolitan region between New York and Washington. What's kind of unique about it? What is it that kind of draws you to writing about Philly as opposed to any of these other cities? Is it just because it's your home, or there are more specific things?
It could be just because I know it so well, or I've come to know it. And actually, the signal thing for someone who's an urban observer is that after 30 years of observing this city, I'm not bored with it. And I'm still seeing it differently. And actually, through this book, Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City, I've come to see the city differently, and that's a kind of remarkable achievement or change for me. So yes, Philadelphia, fifth largest city in the United States, once the largest, once the second largest, once the third largest, once the fourth largest, now the fifth largest. So you know, there, it's a city of loss in that regard. And I think people understand that to some extent. It was the nation's capital. It was the state capital. It was the financial capital of the early U.S. It was the Manchester, I guess we would say, probably second only to Manchester as a city of industrial might of the 19th century. So those things, and probably those are understandable narratives for Liverpudlians or people from Manchester to understand that. And I think that's present in Philadelphia. For me, it's a combination of a city of contradiction. It's a combination for me of the kinds of contradictions that we face in Philadelphia that are so apparent in the streetscape. So it's always been, from the very get-go, both a city of incredible ambition. William Penn wanted to create a great city, a great port city. And at the same time, he was plagued with this notion of creating a safe, green city that would be tempered from both moral turpitude and also things like fire. So he experienced the London fire. So we've internalized these contradictions from the very beginning, and you can actually read them in the streetscape. This is a very, very complicated place, in part because of its form that respects the human being at the sort of personal level. And here's a good example. So it's almost silly, but it also is a helpful example. The Signal event, you know, an annual event in New York City, is the Thanksgiving Day Parade. And during the Thanksgiving Day Parade, you spend your time with your head cranked up to the sky, looking at the floats go by, and it's a moment of wonder. Well, we have our moments of wonder in Philadelphia. We also have a Signal Parade event, which is called the Mummers Parade, and a concept that comes from parts of Great Britain and other places in Europe. And that happens on New Year's Day. And it's a controversial kind of event for the ways that certain kinds of attitudes get played out in the Mummers Parade and the socioeconomic and demographic dimensions to it. But beyond that, it's a parade for people. And as it goes along Broad Street for miles and miles, hour after hour, people join into it. They come into the street and dance with the performers. So this is a city where everything turns personal and is weighted to the ground in a certain way. And at the same time, as I said, it's a city of contradictions. Philadelphia had the first tallest building in North America. In the 18th century, we had the tallest building in North America, which was Christ Church. And, you know, so there was this ambition to build tall. Again, in the 19th century, our city hall was meant to be the tallest building in the world, but the Eiffel Tower beat it out by the time it was completed. During the World's Fair of 1876, we had built the largest buildings in the world. And that ambition, it gets reflected in all kinds of ways. So there's this on the ground level thing about the city that gets represented in the row house form of our streets. And there is a soaringness that plagues us too, because we still want to be, and we still believe ourselves to be, one of the great cities in the world. And Philadelphia was a top 10 city by population, probably until about 1920.
I mean, as we've kind of touched on, like, Philadelphia was like one of the key cities in the early history of firstly the colonial era and then the early history of the United States. And it's since been overtaken first by sort of Chicago and those Midwestern cities, but also Washington, D.C. as a planned capital, and then the rise of the West and so on. Do you reckon this kind of has an impact on the psyche of the city, this kind of knowledge of kind of, for want of a better way of putting it, sort of lost greatness, lost stature?
Yeah, there's no question that part of our narrative that we imbibe and inhabit personally is that narrative of loss. You know, this is both realer than people from the outside believe it to be, and less ridiculous, less absurd. So, as you know, the Eagles won the Super Bowl last night, and part of that narrative is that football team was a team of underdogs, so we take that underdog role personally. We have a chip on our shoulder because of all those losses that get reflected in sports or whatever, or the loss of stature. All cities, including London, endured an economic collapse of the 1970s. So all of the cities of the West lost population, not including places like probably Houston and Los Angeles and places of the American West. But those traditional cities of the Western Hemisphere all got their asses kicked in the 1970s by deindustrialization and a kind of collapse of the urban order. Some cities, though, recovered a lot better. European cities Like Paris and London recovered a bit faster. New York and Boston recovered a bit faster than Philadelphia. So there's this kind of enduring thing that we're still trying to catch up. It's real. I mean, Philadelphia was the financial center of the new United States. And it was until the 1830s and almost the 1840s, we had the central bank and all of the most important banks that underscored the financial system of the new country existed here. And we kept some of that into the 20th century. But those banks are still here. Like, we can walk by and say, there's the loss. There's that Greek revival, Greek temple of a bank that once held the deposits of the United States Treasury well into the 19th century, doesn't anymore. So we can feel it. We can see it. We can know that we were the most productive place in North America in the late 19th century and know that we don't produce anything anymore. So it is real, but at the same time, our economic system is large. This is a region of over 6 million people. It's diverse. It counters that narrative too. And so, as I said, it's both not as serious as it's made out to be and also real.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So why does that decline happen? Like, why is it that Philadelphia is one of the great cities of the United States in 1820, but it's kind of lost that status by 1920? Is it just the expansion of the country? I mean, what's the logic here?
I think there's a couple things. The logic is, I think, that the city that pioneers so much inevitably falls behind. So if you pioneer environmental protection for your water system in the early 19th century by building a park around the river that feeds your water system and building the first municipal water system in North America in the very early 19th century, inevitably, it's going to be hard to keep that at the forefront. And you don't. And so by the late 19th century, where you once had like an ice skating mecca, like one of the great ice skating meccas of North America was in Philadelphia in the middle of the 19th century. By the late 19th century, the water of our two rivers is too polluted for it to freeze, you know, reliably freeze. And so I think it's part of being ahead. You can't stay ahead. And then the country moves west and other places, of course, Chicago demands a kind of hegemony. And then it moves west continuously until Los Angeles and California. But I will say there's another logic as well that's maybe more particular to Philadelphia. And that's in part that Philadelphia actually remained incredibly relevant and significant to the foundation of this country, its politics, its business in profound ways. The Pennsylvania Railroad, which was based in Center City, Philadelphia, was the largest corporation in America and well into the 20th century. So the economic relevance, the Drexel Bank was one of the great banks of the United States well into the 20th century and so on. And we produced more of the consumer products that made the middle class of the United States than any other city. So that relevance continued. I say until about 1925. And that's when deindustrialization began for various reasons here. And at the same time, the city began to be, or the grasp of a very corrupt political machine got harder on the city's politics and economics, and strangled the city so fiercely in the later part of the 1920s that though there was major ambition to build public works, and some of those things were built, such as the first suspension bridge in the United States, the Benjamin Franklin Bridge. That was about 1925. But then you get a little further into that decade and the city bankrupts itself because of corruption, trying to put on a World's Fair for the sesquicentennial of the United States, and fails to build the infrastructure that it needs to continue growing. Bankrupts itself so that the Depression begins a little bit earlier. That political machine somehow maintains power, and it's a Republican machine. And so it eschews the New Deal for quite a long time, making it harder for the city to recover until 1936 or 1937, by which time it's a little bit too late and some major issues have not been taken care of. Meanwhile, New York has built 11 new skyscrapers, taking advantage of cheaper labor during the Depression. That's when Philadelphia really slips and gets really crushed by the Depression. The manufacturing base comes back a little bit, substantially during World War II, where one of $6 that the United States government spent on the war effort was spent in the Philadelphia region, mostly on manufacturing of all kinds, from materials to ships and armaments. But when the war ends, the deindustrialization, you know, it makes those plants, which sort of retrofitted themselves for war production, they're no longer relevant to the economic system. And the building of the interstate highway system, which, you know, made it very difficult for a lot of cities, particularly of the East Coast, these things became particularly hard because of the economic and political makeup of Philadelphia, and the city fell further behind. And at the same time, was so wedded to that manufacturing economy that it held on to it and made a political attempt through policy to keep the industrial base alive. They actually, they pioneered policy to try to keep industry working in the city by creating industrial parks instead of giving up on it and retrofitting the economy for finance and service as Boston and New York did much more rapidly. And that holding on, one of the concepts in Philadelphia, finding the hidden city, is the notion of the long goodbye. We were rich enough to build an epic amount of monumental buildings of all kinds in the 19th century, but we were too poor in the late 20th century to wipe them out, to erase them. And that sort of engendered that long goodbye. We held on. We hold on to things dearly in Philadelphia. It's the sense of everything being felt very personally here. For a city of 1.5 million people, which doesn't sound that large anymore, maybe in the 21st century, it's a substantial amount of people in a region of 6 million, almost 7 probably at this point. Things are felt personally here. And you can sort of follow that back to the structure, the physical form of the city based on the row house.
So as you mentioned, the book is called Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City. That's kind of quite an intriguing title. What exactly is the hidden city you've been in search of there?
Well, it has many meanings. In 1961, I think, a writer by the name of Nathaniel Burt, fairly substantial nonfiction writer of his day, wrote a book called The Perennial Philadelphians. And he sought to make sense of Philadelphia in that moment. But in the way his mind was geared, and also the way a lot of people, you know, who had seen like films like The Philadelphia Story, they sort of elided Philadelphia with Philadelphia's legacy upper class. We have a very European-like, or have, and there's only remnants of course, left today. But well into the 20th century, we had a legacy aristocracy in this city that was land-based. You know, it was based in its suburban estates, where wealth was passed down in an almost un-American sort of way. And Nathaniel Burt, in trying to characterize the world that those people lived in, called it the hidden city. But he also tried to turn that concept towards the city as a whole, and he actually called it, you know, it's a city that hides its secrets. It's built behind an oriental wall. And what he meant by that was that there was a metaphysical wall that when people from New York or California came here, they couldn't quite understand it. And at the same time, there was a physical wall that was known as the Chinese Wall, that was the Pennsylvania Railroad viaduct that ran straight through the center of the city, splitting it in half and down to Broad Street Station, which at one point was the largest railroad terminal in the world. And so here was this city behind its forbidden wall. We sort of took that concept and took it as far as we could in terms of trying to understand its various meanings to the city of today. Some of that is going underground. On the cover is a picture of a 20-foot sewer culvert, the Mill Creek Sewer, with water department worker walking through it. So, of course, there's a hidden underground city. There's a city that gets hidden over and over again through its accumulated layers. And we posit that Philadelphia, unlike New York and other cities of the United States, has developed in a different pattern that is mostly by accretion, with layers building up over time and never by catastrophic means, by fire, earthquake, or massive growth. And a way to think about this is that 100 years ago, 1918, Philadelphia had the same population size of 1.5 million people that it has today. So you have a flatline city, and that flatline guards massive growth and then steep decline of deindustrialization. But at the same time, it tells us a story of a city that is far more stable and that grows slowly through an accretive process than one that grows or changes by catastrophic change, such as the way that Rem Koolhaas, for example, thinks about New York in Delirious New York. So we sort of posit that as an opposite in our book. And so some of the hidden cities hidden in those layers. Some of it is hidden narratives that well into the 20th century don't show up in the main narrative of Philadelphia. That is, say, African-American city. This was the first great black city of the United States. And yet, well, and you know, Nathaniel Burton, his book about Philadelphia 1961, could hardly mention black life in the city. You wouldn't even have known what it was if you fell on it. And yet, such a vital piece of the city, that there's no question that, you know, what do we know about it from the early 20th century? We know the Harlem Renaissance, but we don't know that such an enormous number of major black artistic figures lived here on South Street and inhabited a world that has largely been hidden from our own narrative about our city. So there are narrative layers that are hidden. So we try to take that conceit as far as we can while not losing control of the concept in this book.
As I said, I think Philadelphia is not a city that people overseas would necessarily have a clear mental image of in the way they do with New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco and so on. Philadelphia is kind of not quite as well known outside the United States. What is unique about it? How would you sort of sell it to a British person planning a trip to the US? Like, why should they go to Philly rather than somewhere else?
There is a funny combination here of a kind of European form or sensibility about what a city should feel like. That is, we have a real center. So last night, after the Eagles won the Super Bowl, what happens in Philadelphia is, I think, very particular. The minute the game is over, everyone walks out their front door, you know, in a row house neighborhood, walks out their front door, and all of a sudden there's a communing of people in the street, and they all walk together towards the center of the city, towards Broad Street, and they all gather there. And there's a kind of almost force that's guiding them, an emotional force, a force of like lived patterns for decades and centuries that is present in the way we live in the city today. And I think that's really particular. I can't imagine another city in America. You have to understand that most cities in America are decentralized. They're not densely populated. They don't really, even like where the Super Bowl was, Minneapolis, doesn't hold together in the same way. That's a very basic American city, in the same way that Philadelphia does in its traditional form and its density. And yet that row house architecture means that it's personal. So people walk out and they join each other in the street. We'll also say that it's a very beautiful city. It's almost like, you know, the Englishness of the city, you know, it's like Portugal and Brazil. There's something more English about Philadelphia maybe than London in a kind of way. And it's almost as if we speak old English here. Like if you walk on some of our smaller streets that feel like they would come from the old world. And so, and somehow has been protected and preserved here. So there's an extraordinary charm that rubs right up against massive glass skyscrapers. The city was planned by William Penn, and so it has a kind of order to it that is understandable. And then I would say that it is so notably a place of contrast and contradiction and humanity in terms of race, in terms of wealth, in terms of expression. So if I can be succinct and answer your question, I think Philadelphians are the reason that people ought to visit Philadelphia. It's the people, it's their passion, connection to the city and to each other. I had an Italian friend stay here. We house swapped and we stayed in her apartment in Torino. She lived here and she was here during July 4th. And she said, I learned what the magic about what Philadelphia is. It's the people. And it's that connection across race, across ethnicity, immigrant status. It's reflected in today in the way we're so cognizant of trying to be respectful of each other and welcoming to immigrants at a very fraught moment in American history, and that's felt on the street.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.